Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We take for granted today the art of branding, fixing in the public's mind an idea that is so tangible you can taste it or smell it or touch it or, as in the case of Bacardi rum, all three. Many among us associate that rum with Puerto Rico, but as National Public Radio veteran correspondent Tom Gelton explains in his new book, Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba, The Biography of a Cause, the name Bacardi and the rum that made the name famous is as integral to the modern history of Cuba as the charcoal filtration process is to rum. Tom, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, Ann.
How did it occur to you to chronicle the Bacardi family history?
I started out wanting to write a book about Cuba. I spent 4 years as NPR's Latin America correspondent in the 1980s, and after that I went to Eastern Europe and reported on the end of communism in Eastern Europe. And the combination of those two experiences led me, beginning in the mid-1990s, to have a lot of curiosity about what was going to happen next in Cuba. I became actually obsessed with Cuba in some ways because of my previous reporting experience, and I started to spend a lot of time there. I was going there once, twice, three times a year for NPR, and I just became fascinated, not just by the idea of questions about what was going to happen to Cuba in the future, but also about Cuban history and what made Cuba unique. And, you know, it is kind of a forbidden island to us. I mean, we haven't for 50 years been able to travel freely to Cuba. And I just had a lot of curiosity, and I wanted to explore Cuba in great depth. However, I decided I wanted to write a book about it, but I wanted to find a way to make this Cuba story something that was accessible and interesting to a broad audience. And to me, what makes a story interesting is if you can really make it as a story, tell it as a story, as a narrative, with characters that readers can follow, with a beginning, a middle, and an end. You know, not just a history book, but a story. I sort of take a kind of a literary approach, I think, in this book. It is in some ways almost like a historical novel. That's the way that I conceived it. The Bacardi family, as it turns out, have been involved in one way or another in sort of everything that's happened in Cuba over the last 150 years. And that's not an exaggeration. I mean, at every turning point in Cuban history, in every phase of Cuban history, there's some little Bacardi angle. I mean, it's not a big angle, but it's enough of an angle that by following the Bacardi's adventures over all these years, their involvement in various aspects of Cuban life, you sort of can tell. I was able to relate how Cuba developed throughout this period, but do it in a way, you know, that is entertaining and around the story of a family and not just some sort of dry history book.
But the name Bacardi didn't occur to you immediately. You came around to that a little bit by accident, didn't you?
Well, that's right. What happened in 1999, I was covering a trademark dispute between Bacardi and Pernod Ricard, which is a big French liquor company. They were in court over who was going to have rights to the so-called Havana Club trademark. Now, this sounds like a kind of a boring little business story, which on one level it was, but I realized only in the process of exploring that story, that's when I came to find out that the Bacardis took their Cuban heritage so seriously and had such an involvement in Cuban history going back so long. And I had, you know, for a couple of years, I've been looking around, how can I tell this Cuba story in a fresh way? And when I realized that the Bacardis had this long involvement in Cuban history, it was kind of an aha moment. I decided at that point that I would tell the Cuba story through the example of the Bacardis.
I noticed that the book was reviewed three times in the New York Times.
Yes,
now, I'm assuming you don't have an uncle there, so I assume it's in different sections as well. What's the broad appeal there?
Isn't that
Yeah.
My publicist at Viking said that she didn't remember that ever happening
before.
Did
she get a bonus for that? Or
No, it's just, you know, there's a lot of interest in it. It was reviewed in the business section, which makes sense. It was reviewed in the art section because it is literary, and then it was reviewed in the Sunday Book Review, which is actually a completely separate part of the newspaper.
Right.
But, you know, one of the things that this gets to, Ann, is that one of the things I'm proudest of is this book is that it's got significance on different levels. I mean, it is a business story, and it was reviewed in the business section of the New York Times as a business story. The Bacardi Corporation is a fascinating business story in itself. It's now worth something like $10 to $15 billion. It is still, to this day, owned entirely by 500 or 600 Bacardi family members. It's a private corporation, a wholly owned family corporation. It's very unusual in the annals of business history for a family corporation to last six generations, which is how long the Bacardis have been in control of their company. Usually family corporations peter out after three or four generations. They go public, they sell out, et cetera. But the Bacardis have held on to their company for all this time. And throughout this period, they've maintained this kind of national identity as a Cuban family interested in Cuban issues. They no longer make just rum. They now make Grey Goose vodka, Dewar's whiskey, Bombay Sapphire gin. So they've diversified. They're very international, multinational in their scope. And the fact that they that much of their success has just come in the last 40 years after being confiscated. They lost all their operations in Cuba, which was their home territory. All their operations were nationalized in Cuba in 1960. And in fact, that's what, in some ways, what prompted them to become so successful, because it forced them to go international. It forced them to diversify, which was a brilliant move on their part. Some Bacardi family members actually tell me that Fidel Castro did them a favor by expropriating all their properties. So there's the business story. And then there's the kind of the literary aspect of it, which is why it was reviewed in the art section. And it's just, I think, an interesting book about Cuba. So it got in a Sunday book review. So there's, you know, it's got significance on many different levels. I think I have reached out to many different types of readers.
It is interesting how long the family stayed together. How much of that is in terms of business? How much did you learn that had to do with the fact that they were so vividly Cuban, that it didn't just start with the post, after their exile? It began long ago. They were very nationalistic, big part of their company.
Yeah. This goes all the way back to Emilio Bacardi, who was the son of – the company was founded in 1862 by Facundo Bacardi, who was an immigrant from Spain. And he was always loyal to his mother country. He did not feel very Cuban. There were many Spanish immigrants to Cuba at that time. Emilio Bacardi was the first Bacardi to be born in Cuba, and he came of age at a time when Cuba was in the midst of its struggle for independence from Spain. There was a real lively independence movement, a war. This is now in the 1860s. Emilio got involved in that. He was friends with Jose Marti, who's a famous Cuban patriot, and a number of others. He was actually a conspirator in that independence drive. And then that war was unsuccessful. A second war for independence broke out in the 1890s. Once again, Emilio was deeply involved in that. He sent his own 17-year-old son, Emilito, off to fight in the war. Emilio was both in the first independence war and in the second, was arrested because of his conspiratorial activities. He was sent off to Spain in prison. After the war concluded in 1898, with the U.S. intervention, Emilio came back to Cuba, and he was made the first Cuban mayor of Santiago under the U.S. military occupation. So thanks largely to Emilio, the Bacardi name in Cuba was associated with the independence movement and the national cause early on, and then subsequent Bacardi generations sort of carried that on. The other main character in my book, besides Emilio, is Pepin Bosch, who actually married into the family. He married Don Facundo's granddaughter, and he took over the company in the 1940s, and once again, in the Bacardi tradition, became deeply involved in Cuban politics and the Cuban national struggle, this time against Batista, as opposed to the Spanish. And then Pepin Bosch was a very close ally of Fidel Castro. So throughout their history, Bacardis have always been associated in one way or another with the kind of the national cause. The subtitle of the book, Anne, is The Biography of a Cause. Mm-hmm. And the cause here is the Bacardi's commitment to understanding of the Cuban national struggle. And it's gone through many phases over the last 150 years, their connection to Cuba. And this is kind of the life story of that Bacardi connection with Cuba over all these years.
Having that connection to Cuba, that parallel commitment to that, as well as their business, do you think that that helped keep the family more cohesive in terms of business?
Well, you asked a bit ago about the fact that this company, as this family company, has stayed together throughout these generations. Mm-hmm. And I think that the answer that I've gotten when I've asked people how Bacardi was different from other companies in that regard, in 1960, they had all of their operations in Cuba confiscated by the Cuban authorities. They were all forced into exile. They lost everything in Cuba. Some of them left Cuba with just the shirt on their back. But what they did have was their company. They had managed to sort of relocate outside Cuba before this happened. And so it was, in that sense, the company that sort of saved the family. And that experience of going into exile and having to sort of go back to square one, it reinforced the attachment between the Bacardi family and the Bacardi company. And it kind of gave the company a new lease on life as a family operation. And it sort of underscored the family character of that company. And I think that that's the reason that it has maintained its family identity. The company has not, that's the reason it hasn't sold out up until now, because, the family character of the company was really reinforced by this shared experience of going into exile.
Was Pepin Bosch the fellow who went to Mexico to close down a plant but ended up keeping it open?
You're right, Anne.
Tell the rum and coke story. I love that.
Pepin Bosch was, well, first of all, to set that up, I'm just going to very briefly say that what the Bacardis produced that made it their company so successful was a new type of rum, a light white rum that went down very easy and that that appealed to a much broader segment of the market. Up until that point, rum had been a very rough drink. And as you said in the beginning, with this new type of filtration and aging and so forth, they produced this very light, easy-to-drink white rum that mixed with other beverages. And so it was the introduction of this new type of rum that nobody else was producing at the time that made possible the age of cocktails. The Cuba Libre, the rum and coke, the daiquiri, the mojito, these are all drinks that were made originally with Bacardi rum because no one previously had made a rum that could mix easily with other beverages. Bacardi rum was known as the mixable one. So there's an interesting story about how the rum and coke cocktail got introduced. American soldiers who were occupying Cuba from 1898 to 1902 received large shipments of Coca-Cola, and all the bars that served American soldiers served Coca-Cola, and allegedly there's a bunch of American soldiers in a Havana bar drinking Coca-Cola one day, and the bartender says, guys, have you ever thought of mixing a little Bacardi rum with that Coke? And they said no, and so he went down the line and poured drinks for them all, and it became an instant hit. And from that moment on, allegedly, the rum and Coke cocktail was invented. Now, you asked about Pepin Bosch going to Mexico.
To Mexico.
He went to Mexico in the 1930s, so we're not talking about 30 years later after the rum and Coke was invented. And
okay.
The Bacardi rum operation in Mexico was in real trouble then. But one of the things that Pepin Bosch noticed is Mexicans love Coca-Cola. And Bacardi publicity in Mexico had not really made much of an effort to promote its connection with Coca-Cola. So Pepin Bosch, who was a brilliant marketer, decided that the key to commercial success in Mexico was to really emphasize the rum and coke. And so he, worked out a kind of a joint marketing agreement with Coca-Cola in Mexico. Their factories were nearby one another, and he really emphasized Bacardi as being a partner with Coca-Cola. And that decision by itself completely turned the company's success in Cuba around.
We're going to take a short break. You are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking with NPR correspondent and author Tom Gelton about his new book, Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba, The Biography of a Cause. Call 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org to join the conversation when we return. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
You are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning. I'm Emma Fett in for Amy Jurevich this week. It's a beautiful day today, sunny and 75 right now, high expected around 85. Clear and cool tonight, low around 60. Tomorrow should be more nice weather, partly cloudy and a high around 83. Last September, the economic meltdown rallied the financial community around government solutions. Now the crisis has eased. But so is the consensus among regulators and financial institutions. Moving forward for the economic crisis, but in what direction? That's today on All Things Considered, starting at 4, here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Podcast new and archived news stories from WOSU and NPR. Listen to an interesting story again or get the news on your time. Podcast news anytime online at WOSU.org. Now back to All Sides with Ann Fisher here on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera. Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera.
You are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking with NPR correspondent and author Tom Gelton about his new book, Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba, The Biography of a Cause, and that kind of makes you want to go have a rum and coke right now. Call 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org to join the conversation. Tom, when you decided to do the story about the Bacardis, how did you approach the family?
Really good question. And, you know, it took me a long time to write this book. Years went into the preparation of this book, the research and everything. And I've since told friends that I could not have picked two more difficult entities to work with than the Cuban government and the Bacardi family, because neither of them are known for being particularly open or cooperative with outsiders. The Cuban side of that is obvious enough. I mean, they're sort of very suspicious of American journalists. The Bacardis, because they are a family corporation, are not required to talk to anybody. I mean, there's no, you know, they don't file disclosure forms. Their annual report's a secret. And they are a private company that does not share details of its operations with anybody outside of, you know, close financial analysts and so forth. And for a long time, their default position has basically been, say whatever you want about us, you know, write whatever you want. We just don't talk to people. So that's been, you know, they have traditionally had the reputation of being a very secretive family. You asked how I approached them. Mm-hmm. As it turns out, I found out from my work in Cuba that a Bacardi family member had been in Santiago, in 2002, to sort of revisit her origins there. And with a little bit of digging, I figured out who it was, and it turned out that it was a Bacardi family member who lived here in the Washington, D.C. area, in fact, just a few blocks from where I live. And I reached out to her, and I said, she was my first contact. I said, look, I'm interested in your family history. I'm not, you know, I think that there is a story here that has never been told before. And that's basically the way I did it. And I just took one family member at a time and talked to them and said, look, I'd be really interested in telling your family story, and would you share some of your recollections with me? And I never had a formal working relationship with the Bacardi company. I instead approached it purely on a family basis, family member by family member. It took a while, but I gained the confidence of enough family members who were willing to sit down and talk to me and give me hours and hours of interviews that I was able to put the story together.
How were you able to sift through it all? You know, when you're talking 150 years, you're talking hundreds of people in a family, how do you sift through it and figure out what's legend and what's real?
Well, that's an important question, and particularly because you're going back so long, you're going back beyond the memory of most of the people that were involved. I mean, I was very relieved when I finally worked my way up to the 1950s because I could actually interview the people who
were alive.
Who made the decisions that I was writing about. Before that, it was all a matter of what I could glean from documents and so forth. With any historian or journalist, you go through archival records. I went through the Library of Congress. I went to archives, Bacardi archives in Florida. I went to the University of Miami. I went through a lot of archives in Havana and Santiago. And you find old letters. You find, you go through old newspaper clippings. I have one of the things in my book is very extensive footnotes. Not
yes.
Not in the pages of the narrative itself. I don't interrupt the narrative. But, if you go to the end of the book, you'll see that almost every assertion that I make is I list the sources that I used in reaching that conclusion. So, because I do think it's important, even in a book that's written for a popular audience and in a literary style, the way mine is, I do think it's important to sort of tell people on what basis you are drawing the conclusions you're drawing.
Yeah, the footnotes are very much appreciated, and I was glad that you didn't put them at the bottom because I'm the one that I'm the type that stops and reads the footnotes before I move on, and it kind of stops you up. Now, you mentioned the Cuban government. Tell me about that. It sounds like you had a lot of access, and they didn't trouble you too much, but maybe not.
Well, here one of the big advantages was that I am a reporter for National Public Radio, and I visited Cuba many, many times in recent years in that capacity as an NPR reporter and reported stories from Cuba. So the Cubans were mostly dealing with me as a news reporter, not as a book writer. I mean, I think that it's interesting when you fill out an application for a visa in Cuba with the Cuban government, one of the things they want to know is, have you ever written a book? They're actually a little suspicious of book writers because book writers take such a long time to produce a book that the Cubans don't really know where you're going with it. They can't keep track of what you're doing and what you're thinking, whereas a daily journalist, they sort of can follow your work. And so I always de-emphasized the fact that I was a book writer and emphasized that I was a journalist, and they apparently found my reporting from Cuba to be fair and responsible, obviously not always complimentary, in fact many times very critical, but I think they felt that I was professional in the way that I did my work there, and that made it possible for me to go back over and over and over again. And they did know that I was interested in the history of Cuban rum and in the Bacardi history, and they knew that I was doing research there at the time, but they basically left me alone. Now, there are many, many archival materials in Cuba that are not accessible to foreigners, and I worked with Cuban historians and Cuban researchers, in accessing some of that material.
How are the archives? How are things kept there in terms of public documents?
Well, they're not as well organized as you can imagine things are at the Library of Congress. They're a little bit more haphazard. Mm-hmm. But I was very impressed with how much care has gone into keeping archival materials. I mean, for example, Bacardi family and Bacardi corporate archival material in Santiago, it would have been easy for them when they took over the company in 1960 just to destroy all that stuff and say this is the vestige of bourgeois capitalism or something like that. But in fact, as far as I know and as far as I can tell, they didn't destroy anything. They sort of boxed up all the records that were left behind when the Bacardis were forced into exile. They put them away. They made some effort to catalog them, not a real serious effort, but some effort to catalog them. And, other materials are much more carefully cataloged. As I say, they're not as well cataloged as archival materials in the United States are, but considering that the resources of this country and also the sort of the bitter feelings that many people in government or the authorities have towards the past, I think it's pretty impressive that they have kept things in as good a shape as they have.
Great. I'm talking with Tom Gelton about his new book, Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba, the biography of a cause. It's All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. What was interesting to me at first blush when I heard about the book, I heard about the story, I thought, well, they were the company was nationalized, everything was taken away from them, and they left. Well, it wasn't that simple. They were actually very supportive of the Castro government at first. They gave them a lot of money.
Indeed. I mean, they had been very active in, and the origins of that is that, well, as I say, for one thing, they had a long history of being on the side of patriotic nationalistic causes in Cuba. They were very opposed to Fulgencio Batista, the Cuban dictator who ruled Cuba mostly in the 30s and 40s and then attempted a comeback in 1952 and was running for the election to be president of Cuba again in 1952. When he saw he was not going to win that election, he led a military coup against the government and established a military dictatorship in Cuba in 1952. The Bacardis were dead set against Batista. And in the forefront, particularly of sort of wealthy upper-class Cuban families, they were in the forefront of those who embraced the revolution and opposed Batista. Individual Bacardi family members, as you say, gave a lot of money to Fidel Castro's movement to buy weapons. Bacardi women were knitting socks for Cuba's for Castro's fighters up in the mountains. Pepin Bosch, the chairman of Bacardi during that period, personally gave what would be today the equivalent of about $250,000 of his own money to buy weapons for Fidel and his fighters. And then when Fidel took power in January of 1959, Pepin Bosch went to the new revolutionary government with a check for $450,000, which was the company's estimate of how much it was going to owe that year in business taxes. And Pepin Bosch gave him the check, you know, a year early so that they could get the government, to help the government get on a stronger financial footing. So they really were exemplary in that regard in the way that they supported this new revolutionary movement. They donated money for the agrarian reform cause. They said, look, we're willing to pay higher taxes. We think Cuba needs sweeping social and economic change. Many Bacardi family members went to other members of the Cuban industrial class and said, look, we need to support this government. This is what they're doing, what they're proposing to do is good for Cuba. So they really went out on a limb, basically for the first year and a half of the revolution after Fidel took power, all the way up until the fall of 1960. The Bacardi stayed in Cuba, and many Cubans had left Cuba at that point. Many Cuban companies had left Cuba. The Bacardi stayed, and they stayed because out of solidarity with the Cuban Revolution. And then in October 1960, what happened is that there was a decision by Fidel Castro and Raul Castro and Che Guevara that they wanted to establish socialism in Cuba, and they didn't want any private enterprise, so they nationalized all private enterprise on the island, including the Bacardi Rum Company. And at that point, the Bacardis go into exile, and having been known for so long as allies of Fidel Castro, they felt betrayed, they felt double-crossed. And once they went into exile, they became fierce, fierce opponents of the Castro regime.
Yeah, hell hath no fury, right?
Exactly.
You said that other companies, other people left, started leaving right away. What is it that they knew that the Bacardis did not see or know?
Well, there are different political feelings. And the truth is that a lot of those people that left early were not in support of the revolution, did not favor the revolution. Many of them were allies of Batista, of the old regime. The Bacardis were, at that time, considered sort of a left-of-center family. I mean, their political profile was different than the political profile of many other Cubans of their class. And I would say the first Cubans that left were ones that, you know, just did not regard this revolution as a good thing and didn't want to have anything to do with it. The Bacardis were different in that regard and that they welcomed it and that they embraced it. There were also, I should also say that even within the Bacardi family, there were differences of opinion. I mean, I mentioned Pepin Bosch, who was very supportive of Fidel Castro. However, he was also one of the first family members to get nervous about what Fidel Castro was doing in Cuba. And I tell a story in the book of Pepin Bosch flying to Washington with Fidel Castro in April 1959. Pepin Bosch, because of his support for the revolution, was chosen by Fidel to be the one and only Cuban businessman to go with him to Washington in April 1959. Well, on that trip, sort of being involved behind the scenes, Pepin Bosch started to get a little nervous about Fidel Castro's plans. He ends up leaving before other Bacardi family members. So you know, this was, there were differences of opinion in Cuba about, you know, whether this was a good thing or not, and there were some people stayed loyal to it longer than others.
They had to shut their eyes to a lot of stuff that was going on, though, the executions at night, that kind of thing. Was that part of the strife within the family? People had a lot of problems with that.
It was, and that was sort of one of the issues that people disagreed about. The Castro brothers and Che Guevara and their allies, when they came to power, carried out a lot of executions. Now, it has to be said, they were executing people who were associated with the Batista regime, largely secret police. That allegedly the people that were tried and executed had blood on their hands for having themselves been assassins or torturers or something like that. And it has to be said that there was a lot of public support for those executions at that time. I mean, Cuba just come through a very, very bloody period. I read from press reports at the time, even people like Pepin Bosch, who didn't like it. But he also said that if they hadn't done something like that, that the people's rage was so bottled up that, you know, you might have seen vigilante justice and so forth. There was a lot of popular rage against those Batista types that, you know, had to be channeled in one way or another. But you're absolutely right. There were differences of opinion, and some of the Bacardi family members, when they saw all those executions taking place, started to have second thoughts about what was going on in Cuba. And, of course, by October 1960, when the Castro regime declared itself to be socialist, more or less, that sort of was the last straw for a lot of them.
You are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking with NPR correspondent and author Tom Gelton about his new book, Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba, The Biography of a Cause. Give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org to join the conversation when we return in a moment. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, 1 year after the collapse of Lehman Brothers, we'll look at whether Wall Street is vulnerable to yet another crisis. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point is coming up today at 1 here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning. Thanks for tuning in today. Coming up at noon, President Obama speaks in Manhattan on the first anniversary of the collapse of Lehman Brothers. Hear the speech and reaction with Neil Conan, Mara Liasson, and Scott Horsley. Shaping up to be a beautiful day. Currently it's sunny and 76, high expected around 85. Clear tonight with a low around 60. Tomorrow should look much like today, high around 83. When you don't have time to catch the whole story, get the update with the WOSU Daily News Loop. Receive award-winning local coverage and NPR headlines emailed every weekday right to your inbox. Catch up with current events or listen to a story you missed. Don't miss a beat with the WOSU Daily News Loop. To sign up, go to wosu.org/email. And now back to more All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Tom Gelton, the NPR correspondent and author of his new book, Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba, The Biography of a Cause. Tom, tell us about some of the characters that you learned about in the process of doing your research and how they fit into your story. There's some really, really interesting people, strong personalities.
Vivid personalities. And probably the leading one is someone I mentioned earlier, Emilio Bacardi, the first Bacardi born in Cuba, the son of the founder. He was, on the one hand, he took over the presidency of the company after his father's death. So he was a businessman. He was a prominent member of the Santiago Cuba Chamber of Commerce. On the other hand, he was a revolutionary. He was involved in smuggling weapons and arms to Cuban independence fighters in the mountains. He was secretly raising funds for the revolutionary movement. He was kind of a courier. He devised a very ingenious code system for communicating with the firefighters in the mountains. He was also a literary person. He wrote poetry. He wrote plays. He wrote novels. He wrote a 10-volume history of his hometown, which is a fascinating story in itself. And he was involved in politics. He became the first, after the United States occupied Cuba in 1898, a bunch of Cubans went to the U.S. military governor and said, we would like to have a Cuban as our mayor in Santiago. And the man that they suggested was Emilio Bacardi. He went on to be a Cuban senator, and he was, for a time, considered to be a candidate for Cuban president. So he was a man of many, many different hats, fascinating character. You know, he was a founder of the Victor Hugo Free Thinker Group in Cuba. He hated the Catholic Church. He was very secular. He did not believe in the divinity of Jesus. He and his wife actually founded a Raja Yoga school in eastern Cuba, and they raised their daughters. They had mostly daughters. They raised them to be suffragettes and women's rights activists, which was a pretty remarkable for that time in Cuba, of all places. So, fascinating character. And then the other one that I really focus on, well, I write a lot about José Martí, who wasn't obviously a Bacardi person, but he was a close friend of Emilio Bacardi and the so-called apostle of Cuban independence, and a figure who lived in the United States for a long time and was himself a journalist and wrote perceptibly about the United States. I learned a lot about José Martí in writing this book. He's another really interesting character. But the other main Bacardi character is this guy that I've been talking about, Pepin Bosch, you know, sort of in the third or fourth generation, took over the company in the 40s, married into the family, but again, probably the Bacardi person most responsible for the company's survival. He led the company during the last years in Cuba. He's the one who steered it back to success once it went into exile.
Facundo L. Bacardi, he took over in 2005.
Yes.
And he has no personal experience with Cuba.
Born in Chicago, I believe.
Yeah, but he's promised to someday reestablish the Bacardi company in its homeland. Why is this important now? What difference does it make, ultimately?
Well, you know, at this point, as you have noted, the Bacardis are not known for their Cuba connection. I mean, commercially, the company makes no mention of its Cuba connection. There's no mention of Cuba on its bottle. Their publicity makes no mention of Cuba. They are now a multinational company. They produce all these other things besides rum. So they have evolved a long ways from their days as a little family rum company in Cuba. They are now, you know, they now really have to think much more globally about their operations and their business strategy and so forth. Their interest in Cuba at this point is much more personal. It sort of comes out of their own family history. They would be interested in going back and sort of reassociating the Bacardi name with Cuba, I think, but more for personal reasons. I don't think at this point that Cuba figures all that largely in their commercial planning. I mean, the Bacardi name is much bigger than Cuba right now. And as I say, people don't even associate Bacardi with Cuba. So if you were to all of a sudden see in the stores a Bacardi rum made in Cuba, it wouldn't necessarily, you know, make that much of an impression on you. Back in Cuba, the Bacardi name is still well known. And if they were to produce a rum for domestic consumption in Cuba, that might be something interesting and that might be something promising for the company, but it would be a tiny part of their overall operation. So he has Facundo Bacardi, who now is in the sixth generation from his great-great-grandfather, Facundo Bacardi, the founder, has shown interest in going back to Cuba. But as I say, it would be more of a, I hate to say it's a token thing, but it would mean more for sort of family, historical, political symbolism than anything else.
Scene in the story, and it might have been the woman, the Bacardi woman who, from Washington near where you live, who went back to Cuba to visit and there were people there that remembered them and that were actually taking care of some of the buildings in their compound or wherever they lived. Do you remember that part?
Yeah, that was this woman who lives nearby me here in the Washington D.C. area. She went back, and most of the Bacardis had left. She was a Bacardi on her grandfather's side, and the people that she tracked down were on her grandmother's side. So they weren't actually Bacardis; they were family relatives of hers, but through sort of the non-Bacardi side of her family. They had been close family friends of her grandparents when they lived there. And when the Bacardis left Cuba in 1960, they left a lot of their furniture. When people went into exile, they gave away a lot of their stuff. It's not as though this woman was holding on to her Bacardi assets. I mean, basically, she had left a lot of her furniture with this woman. And she went back, and this Bacardi woman, looked up this other lady, and they had a reunion of sorts, and it was kind of poignant because on the one hand they were living in a beautiful house and had beautiful furniture, but they were very poor. And I tell the story of how this woman visited the Bacardi lady in her hotel and was sort of dazzled by the everything from the little shampoo bottles, that hotel guests have, to the layout at the breakfast buffet. These were all luxuries that were unimaginable to her.
What about the future? What have you learned through your research that gives you any special insights about Cuba and the future? Fidel Castro I don't know if he's out of picture or not. He just popped up again. But for the most part, his brother Raul is serving as president. What do you see ahead based on your research?
Well, it's interesting, and I went to Cuba in 1994, right after I had been in Eastern Europe when all these socialist regimes collapsed so quickly and so dramatically. And my expectation and that of many people who were looking at Cuba at that time was that Cuba was going to follow very quickly. I mean, Cuba just lost billions of dollars a year in aid from the socialist bloc. There was a lot of discontent in Cuba, and many of us just figured that that Cuba was going to be next.
Yeah.
And now we're 15 years later, and that government is as solid in power as ever, it seems. And one of the lessons of that for me is that it's very dangerous to make predictions or to think that you have Cuba figured out. I wrote an article recently about Cuba as the inscrutable nation. I mean, I think one of the reasons I've kept going back to Cuba is I just sort of, at one level, don't feel like I've got it figured out yet. It's a really complicated place, and it's hard to sort of understand what people are really thinking. So that's all kind of a caveat. That makes me very nervous about or reluctant to make any kind of predictions about where things are going in Cuba. I do think, and this is really stemming from my work in the rum sector in Cuba, which is one of the very few promising sectors of the Cuban economy. Cuban rum is a product that I think has a bright future, commercial future, regardless of who's in control in Cuba. And if you look just at that sector, a lot of the people involved in the rum industry right now, because it is a state-controlled industry, a lot of those people, in fact, were appointed to their positions by the Communist Party. These are people whose allegiance is to the Communist Party and the current government. Even though they're active in the rum industry and sort of non-political positions, they're serious management positions. They owe those positions to the Communist Party. Well, my prediction here is, and this is based on my work in Moscow and Poland and other places, is that once things begin to change, a lot of those peoples will go from being communists to being capitalists overnight. I mean, this is what we have seen elsewhere in the post-socialist world. These are people who are first and foremost businessmen. Their allegiance is to whoever is in power at the time, whether that be the communists or whether it be a capitalist government. And I think that what we are likely to see is that a management class, a professional class in Cuba, that can prove itself to be very adept at changing colors and going from declaring loyalty to one type of government very quickly to changing loyalty to another type of government. So I think that it is entirely possible that we would see some dramatic change in Cuba once the Castros are gone and somebody else takes power. But again, I think certainly as long as Fidel is around And probably as long as Raul is around, we're likely to see not a whole lot of change. I was there last in May of 2008. At that point, I was thinking that Cuba was changing pretty rapidly under the direction of Raul. But then starting that summer, which would be a year ago now, things really started to slow down. And maybe this is because Fidel sort of reappeared, came back to life, as it were. Who knows? But we haven't seen in the last 12 months a lot of evidence and change of change in Cuba.
They were talking just a few days ago about in Washington, the talks with Cuba about seeking direct mail service. It's kind of hard to believe after all these years that we still can't mail a letter to Cuba.
Yeah. Well, you know, mail service is something that requires cooperation between governments, and that's something that's been kind of in short supply.
We just don't have.
Yeah.
We've got a caller here now. Rod wanted to ask about that.
Yes. Basically, you know, like I said, I wanted to, you know, you already partially answered my question, you know, concerning the Castro brothers and, you know, the old revolutionaries are dying off. You know, I was wondering what the next generation was going to bring for Cuba. Also, I was wondering about... you know, what future U.S. Cuban relations look like?
Well, you know, this is true on both sides. I mean, Barack Obama said something very interesting when he first talked about Cuba in April, I think it was. He said something like, "Don't blame me for policies that were don't blame me for U.S. policies toward Cuba that were enacted before I was born." So he is of a generation. He was born in 1962, I believe. So he is from the, you know, the current generation. He was not even born when a lot of these U.S. policies were implemented, and a lot of the Cubans were not born when Fidel Castro came to power. So whether we're talking about the Cuban side or the U.S. side, we're talking about a generation of leaders now who really have grown up, you know, without any direct involvement or memory in that confrontational period of the early 60s. And I think that's significant. Barack Obama called for a new beginning with Cuba. And I think that on both sides, you know, you're right. The old guys, Juan Almeida Bosque, who is one of the few remaining comandantes who fought with Fidel in the mountains, just died over the weekend. And, you know, the new generation of leaders in Cuba and in the United States are ones who are, you know, from a much more current period. And I think it's going to be easier for them to put some of the old enmity behind and sort of move ahead. One other factor that cannot be understated, and that is that Barack Obama is an African-American, and 60 to 70% of the population in Cuba now is Afro-Cuban. So we have, and he's talking about things that matter to ordinary Cubans, whether it's restoring mail service or whether it's making it easier for family members to travel to Cuba, making it easier for family members to send money to Cuba. These are reforms that the average Cuban will welcome. So we have here an interesting phenomenon, which is an African-American president speaking largely to an Afro-Cuban population about issues of concern to them. And that's a very different dynamic from, you know, an old white president in America speaking to an old white revolutionary in Cuba. You know, we have a whole different conversation that's taking place right now with different characters and a different dynamic.
What were folks in Cuba saying when Barack Obama was elected president?
Well, I wasn't there, but I am in contact with a lot of Cubans, and there's, from what I can tell, there's tremendous excitement and expectation that this, you know, that there may finally be a sort of change in the tone of the relationship.
All in all, how long did you spend researching the book?
Ooh, 10 years, maybe.
Wow.
Eight to 10 years from the time that it first occurred to me to the time that, you know, it actually came out.
What surprised you the most? What did you not expect?
Well, I think what surprised me the most, because the Bacardis, and as I say, I came through this, I came to the Bacardis very much in the current day. Covering the Bacardis today, the Bacardis have this association in the United States now of being allied with kind of the Republican Party, conservative, maybe you could even say right-wing. Bacardi money underlies much of the Cuban exile movement, which, you know, has taken a fierce line toward Fidel Castro. So the reputation that the Bacardis have is being pretty conservative. And I think one of the things that surprised me the most is that back in Cuba, they had this long history of you know, sort of left of center activism. And as I say, Emilio Bacardi you know, being an anti-clerical guy who founded a Raja Yoga school in Santiago. I mean, there was a whole side to Bacardi history that I never would have imagined on the basis of what I knew about the Bacardis sort of in their current incarnation and with their current political profile.
The whole idea about their playfulness was interesting and what partiers they were.
What
was it about them that made them such partiers in the best sense of the word?
They were a liquor company. I mean, they made their whole fortune, in the age of cocktails. I mean, that was very much their image in Cuba. I mean, they promoted their brand. They promoted their product, which was rum. And Cuba, during all those years, was known as kind of a playground, particularly in the early years of the 20th century, early and middle years of the 20th century. And the Bacardis not only supported political activity, they were the commercial sponsors of Cuban baseball. They were the commercial sponsors of musical programs on Cuban radio. They sponsored the floats in the carnival parades in Santiago. I mean, they were, they were the first sponsors of Cuban ballet. I mean, they were associated, with sort of Cuban life in a very broad sense, Cuban culture. And rum is very much a part of the national culture in Cuba. So the Bacardis were, but at the same time, they had this kind of common touch. They were, because they had grown up, they came from pretty humble origins themselves, but in Santiago, their hometown, the Bacardis, even though certainly by the 20th century they're a very wealthy family, they always had this reputation of being sort of accessible, not like a lot of rich families that are exclusive. They always had very close friends, throughout the sort of social class spectrum. I tell the story in the book of how, when it came to be closing time, in a bar in Santiago, there's usually some Bacardi guy there who would buy everybody around. I mean, they were just known for their generosity and their playfulness, like you say, and they treated their employees very well, and they gave a lot of free liquor to their employees, which has probably also contributed to their party reputation.
They were good corporate neighbors. That's kind of an interesting. I mean, you could almost write a paper just on that about them. You could do another one on their gift for branding.
Yep.
Which was sort of new back
Absolutely.
Then. Of course, they didn't call it that back then. So I can see why the book has been of great interest to a lot of different people. Tom, thanks for joining me today. This is Tom Gelton. He is the author of the book Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba. If you might recognize his name, he is also a veteran international correspondent for NPR News. Thank you very much for joining us. It has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820 NPR News.
WOSU comes from Integrate, helping to improve business performance through brand design and marketing communications for more than 20 years. On the web at integrateinc.com or at 614-421-0004.